Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really exciting founder joining us. I mean, he's been building his company for quite some time and, you know, is quite the rocket ship, but it's a very unique rocket ship because he's been able to bootstrap the whole thing from nothing without any, you know, outside, you know, capital, you know, really supporting on the journey. So on today's show, we're going to be learning, you know, what he learned from his failures, how he has gone about building culture and hiring and firing, as well as how he plans to give away most of his stock to his own employees, which I think is remarkable and one of the first times that we hear, you know, an approach like this one. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Ryan Sitton. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alejandro. It's great to be here.
So originally born in Irving, Texas. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Well, my parents are both teachers. So we grew up fairly what I know today to be modest, although at the time I didn't know that, right? I was just a kid growing up, roof over my head, three squares a day. But what was cool was when your parents, not only were my parents both teachers, they were both science teachers. So my dad, mom, brilliant people. And they also were not just teachers for their profession, but they were teachers at heart. And so always growing up, you know, teaching things. And my dad did everything around the house. Mom did everything around the house. So teaching us everything from how to cook to how to fix the water heater, how to change the oil in the cars. And so I would say that my biggest advantage growing up, or the biggest privilege I had, was to live a life where you just learning was just part of life all the time, right? And the other thing I would add is that mom and dad both prioritized or really valued intellect. They valued intelligence. So learning to figure things out. That was what it was like growing up in Irving. And from the day I was born, all I could remember, mom and dad were talking about you were going to go to college. And that science and math, these were the languages of smart people. And engineer was a natural degree for that. What was interesting was my parents were both the first ever in their families to go to college. But for me, it was just a given. So definitely blessed to be raised in that type of environment.
So obviously engineering, you know, is what you had to study. And you went at it and you did study engineering. Now, in your case, you know, tell us about, you know, the first day, you know, couple of jobs that you had, you know, that led to the latest one in which you actually got fired. So walk us through how that, you know, corporate, you know, career, you know, shaping up.
Yeah. Well, my first job out of college was with Oxy, the big oil and gas company. I actually worked at a chemical plant or chemical division, but that was my first job. Second job was with Marathon, which is also a big industrial company, oil and gas producer. I worked at their refining company at the time. So worked in big industrial facilities, learned a lot during that kind of 3-year journey. And then in 2001, I went to a small company called Berlanger, which is a small consulting company. And man, talk about another blessing. And about learning, the cool thing about going to work at Berwanger was I worked around another founder. The guy's name was Pat Berwanger, and I got to sort of rise up in that company. It wasn't that big. It was 100 people or so when I went to work there. But I got to watch a founder operate. And he was a really unique guy, eccentric guy. But man, talk about getting a really special opportunity to learn both the goods and bads of founding a company. Well, that company, Berwanger, I worked there for 4.5 years. And by the time I had... By middle of 2005, I'd actually started a new division of that company. So the founder there supported me in starting a little division, hiring a couple of employees and getting a chance to start a business, if you will, under his guidance. And then in the middle of 2005, Berwanger sold to Siemens, the big multinational company. And Pat had decided he was going to sell and leave. He was not going to stick around. And his number two guy was going to take over. And that guy and I did not get along. And so when it became clear that, you know, the lines were being drawn, my line was being drawn out. And so right before the sale went through November of 2005, I was shown the door. And man, talk about a hard experience. Like my wife would tell you, that was the closest she had ever seen me to depressed. Like I'd never been fired before. They'd obviously loved me. They'd let me start divisions there. And all of a sudden to have be told that, thank you, no thank you, you can go. That was rough.
Well, how was that for you? I mean, what were the because obviously, you know, like first you go through the period of sadness and disappointment, then it's reflection, then it's just picking yourself back up and you keep it moving. So how was that transition of events for you too and emotions?
Ben, yeah, I'd say Alejandro, I remember the day, I remember showing up at a meeting and them telling me we're gonna for intents and purposes, they wouldn't allow you, but we're gonna sort of suspend you. It was becoming obvious they were just trying to pick the right words to let me go. And I get fired. Go home, and I think it's a Thursday. And a good friend of mine who I'd hired to come work for me there had to come by my house and get my laptop from me because I didn't have it at the office that day. And man, I mean, it was just devastating. My wife would remembers me like laying on the couch for 3 days, just watching TV, not even able to process what was happening. I remember a few days went by and I was trying to figure out how I was going to handle this and could I get my job back and just, you know, all over the place. And I remember I was about a week in and I was really struggling. And I got a call from a friend of mine, Randy Merriweather. And Randy and I didn't know each other really well, but we knew each other well enough. And Randy was the first person to give me the, stop your pity party and get your shit together. And so we're on the phone and he says something like, Ryan, you need to quit wallowing. You're way too talented. Get your resume updated. Send it to me. Let's get it out there. Go out there, start looking for new jobs. And I was in my dining room at the time on the phone with Randy and I sort of walk out. And like I said, my wife still to this day remembers this happened. She's like, Ryan walked out of that dining room just with a like he looked different. And that conversation with Randy, that kind of kick in the shorts, like the coach telling you, get back on the field, get back on the horse. That was that call. And that sort of started things from there. But that 2 week period was hard. It was low.
Well, that ended up being the best thing that has ever happened to you, because obviously that was the segue that you needed to really, you know that it was okay to venture into the unknown. So what happened next?
Yeah, so that was, like I said, it was end of 2005. I ended up taking a consulting job. So it was not a full-time, I was a 1099 consultant working for a smaller engineering firm who was doing this type of work and knew of me. And that was another, to your point, Alejandro, it was interesting to go through that low point and to feel the confidence that I could survive that. Okay. Went to work at this small consulting company, worked there until middle of 2006. And once again, at this point, I wasn't committed to that company, but I didn't know how that was going to go. And it was clear I was not aligned with their objectives and did that work and got paid well to do it. Actually, I was getting paid on an hourly basis, like twice what I was making at Berwanger doing that consulting, but I had no benefits. And by the way, I should say this. When I got fired from Berwanger, my wife was a stay-at-home mom. We had one kid and she was pregnant with our second. So they talk about double income, no kids. We were double kids, no income. And I mean, it was an interesting conversation at the house, like, hey, you know, making some money now. And this is 06. I'm working for this consulting company. I think, hey, middle of the year, May of 2006, I'm going to start my own company. And my wife and I talk about this and she's saying, well, how's that going to work? Like, where are we going to get money from? Now, luckily, we lived fairly frugally, so we had some saved up, and didn't even have to draw on retirement. But this is going to sound like minutia. It was so clear. We had a minivan fund. We had saved up money to buy a new minivan, and I told her, hey, we're going to use that to live off of, and if we go down this road, I can't get enough business, this thing doesn't work, we'll bleed down that, but if it gets to zero, I'll go out and get a job. Like, that's the most we have to lose in this is the minivan fund. And sure enough, to your point, Alejandro, it was a blessing. That started May of 06. Put $10,000 into a bank account, didn't take a paycheck for 6 months, but things started growing and hired our first employee end of that year, end of 06. And then by end of 07, I think we'd hired like 10 employees, had gotten a couple new contracts. And man, it just took off from there.
Well, obviously, I got to ask you, did you ever buy that minivan?
We did. As a matter of fact, it was about a year later. So this is a good story because you think, man, the minivan fund didn't dwindle all the way down, but it dwindled probably. So if it started at like, there was like 40,000 in that minivan fund, it probably got down to about 10. And like I said, we put 10 to start the company. We probably dwindled maybe even all close to zero. And then, but man, we started making, I started paying ourselves beginning of 07, started taking a paycheck. And I think by the end of 07, we had been able to, even though we're not paying ourselves well. In fact, I'll say this. Run this company now 18 years. The first 8 years, My income from Pinnacle did not match what I could have made working a job. 8 years. Like, so a lot of founders would not be that patient. Now, you look today, we've been very blessed. Financially, we're doing really, really well. But that took 5, 6, 7, 8 years of patience before things got big, because we kept plowing money back into the company. We'd have a really good profitable year, make $3 million. We'd leave that sitting in operating accounts to go hire new employees or develop software or develop websites or marketing materials. So it took a long time before the money showed up, if you will.
So for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of Pinnacle? How do you guys make money?
So we, and this is a bit unique. People will look at us from the outside and say, oh, they're a professional services firm. Yes, but our model is quite different. So our specialty is reliability system. So for all of your folks who aren't in technical arenas, you think of your car, right? You back in the day, you bought a car and you'd look at the manufacturer, you know, recommended and say, oh, every 3,000 miles, change the oil. Every 10,000 miles, change the timing belt. Every 20,000 miles, change the fuel filter, right? You had all of these instructions. Now, if you think, now that was for, say, a Honda Accord, and Honda would make a million of those a year. So they had really good information on the Honda Accord to tell you that this is the best maintenance plan to follow. Well, imagine you want a maintenance plan for a chemical plant. And this chemical plant, say, that makes hydrochloric acid, has not one car, but or not one machine, but that chemical plant is made up of 20,000 machines, all of which have to work together in order to bring in the raw products and push out hydrochloric acid. Not only that, there's only one plant just like that in the whole world. So to produce the maintenance plan, the reliability plan for that plant is incredibly complicated. And so we started 20 years ago being the company that would go in and mine the history. So we'd gather all this original documentation and data, and we'd build these very simple but build models and help say, how often do you need to inspect each of these pieces of machinery? How often do you need to do maintenance? Where should you upgrade? So that we started in a very basic way 20 years ago, and over the last 20 years, 18 years, we've evolved into very advanced models. We've built our own software programs that model this stuff. We've got, we've got our own algorithms that we run, but really our bread and butter has always been, we were the guys that would go into the plant and do all of the heavy lifting to set these systems up and get them running. We would get all the data in and get all of the engineering done so that this system would tell you what to do going forward.
So at what point, I mean, going back to the early days, at what point did you realize, hey, I think that we're into something here. I think we're going to be okay.
Yeah, you know, this actually will surprise you. And I will, if I could pull it up. In 2007, I wrote a business plan. So not even a year in business, wrote a business plan. And it was pretty thorough for a guy that was just a year in and was 31 years old at the time. And if you looked at that business plan today, Alejandro, you'd be surprised for how close it is to where we are. Now, it's clearly still a lot different in a lot of ways, but I knew the market for this was just gargantuan. That the big operators out in the world, you know, the big oil and gas companies, the big chemical companies, the big mining companies, while they were good at running their facilities, they were not good at reliability strategy. And so there was a massive, literally a multi-hundred million dollar business if we could figure out how to package this up and take these solutions to customers. Very well, I would say, I realized that there was a big market. We just had to figure out how to deliver the solution to customers in ways that they could understand.
So obviously, you know, here you are running a profitable operation. You know, since the very early beginning, because I mean, you guys bootstrapped the whole thing. I mean, typically when you're building something, you know, meaningful like this, something that has legs, I mean, something profitable, people typically would push you in the direction of getting outside capital and getting investors to jump in. So how were you able to avoid that distraction and just, you know, saying, hey, you know what, we're just going to be okay. We're just going to be building this ourselves without any external money or external people?
Yeah. Two things, maybe three. And I'll tell it myself here a bit. Because you're right. Probably 2 or 3 years in, I started getting real interest from lots of different companies, private equity companies, strategic buyers, a lot of big industrial companies that said, ooh, man, if I could get some of that Pinnacle stuff, we would have got interest from big professional consulting companies that wanted to go into this space. I mean, I'm not exaggerating when I would say I've probably gotten not casual inquiries. I've gotten thousands of casual inquiries. I've probably gotten 300 or 400 serious inquiries. People that knew who we were, I've had people track me down at conferences. I had a guy attend a conference in Houston from another state because he knew I was going to be a speaker. He wanted to follow up me afterwards, see if his firm could invest in us or buy us. So yeah, and lots of this. And so you say, well, Ryan, why would you turn that down? Because it was clear at several moments that, like, man, if I were to sell the company, you know, there'd be hundreds of millions of dollars in my pocket if I would do it. And you might say, and my friends would tell me, Alejandro, they say, Ryan, you're an idiot. Do it. Go sell the thing, get the money. And so why didn't I? One thing that was interesting was money was never really our big, because as I said, I lived fairly, my parents were both teachers. I did not have expensive tastes. So if you said, well, Ryan, here's a gigantic pile of money, that was not going to change my lifestyle much. So that didn't have a big appeal to me, which is that's just lucky, right? Lucky that I didn't have that. Because I think a lot of founders, man, I want private jets and I want a second home and I want my kids to go to Ivy League schools. And, you know, I'd love to just say I'm a $100 million guy, whatever. That tends to warp people's thoughts on the value of dollars. I, for a reason, didn't have that. Two, I knew that, that our limitation wasn't money. Like when I looked out there, we would leave money. If I said, man, we got $3 million in the account. Well, if I had a lot more money, that wasn't really going to change our strategy. Our strategy was how did we go connect with customers more? And just having more money wasn't going to solve that problem. And the third one, and this is where I tell myself, was probably just bold-faced arrogance. I just thought, I'm worth way more than that. So, you know, whether or not I was, you know, most founders do think they are. We've all got a little bit of that chip on our shoulder, but it turned out to be a blessing for me. But that was probably a big reason. So that's why, even though things came in a lot, they just never seemed interesting.
So for you, you're building this thing, you know, and then all of a sudden in 2014, you take a pause. You know, why?
You know, the answer to that is going to be less concrete than I wish it was. But I will say this. I really was not exposed to politics much growing up. My parents weren't involved. I didn't know much about it. And when we moved our business to Pasadena, which isn't a big milestone in our company's history, but it's one that matters for a lot of reasons. In 2009, we moved from Pearland after 3 years to Pasadena, which is just two suburbs of Houston. And when we moved to Pasadena, I got connected into the local political process. I met the mayor through that move. And the mayor introduced me to the local state representative, and that sort of got me involved in politics a little bit. And as I started following politics, now keep in mind, this is 2009, 2010, and at the risk of alienating some of your listeners, I'm a Republican. And I remember that at that time, Barack Obama had just gotten elected president. And while I hadn't paid a whole lot of attention, there was something that struck me. I was, as you said, bootstrapping the company. I was making money. Let's say we've made some years $1 million in profit, but of course the government takes $400,000 of that. I take my $600,000 left over and I don't take any of it. I put it right back in our operating accounts so I can run the company next year and use it to create jobs. Well, I remember that one of President Obama's opening speeches, he was talking about the fact that we needed the rich to pay their fair share. We needed to increase taxes on the rich so that the government could create jobs. And man, that just infuriated me. Because I'm like, man, every dollar you take out of my pocket in taxes is a job I can't create. And you guys are terrible at creating jobs. And that was probably when I really started to get interested in politics. I was aware of, well, government can do some things really well. This was not it. And so fast forward to the three or four, I started getting more involved in politics, started looking at what representatives were voting on. I looked at state and national. And then in 2014, I was involved in a group and the Railroad Commission job, which is the oil and gas regulator for the state of Texas, came open. And I had shown some interest already in a group that I was involved in, said, Ryan, you should run for this. But I say a group, a couple people from that group. I was at dinner and that started happening. And sure enough, man, I threw my hat in the ring, campaigned hard and got elected.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So I think that obviously people skills is a big one, you know, when you go into politics. So what would you say that you learned from that experience? Because, I mean, you were there for 6 years. So what did you really get from that experience, especially from dealing with people that, you know, you would take away with you as a real lesson learned there?
Yeah, man, that's a whole podcast, Alejandro, in and of itself. Because when you've served, I mean, I know, you know, when you are a statewide elected official, which I was, I interacted with everybody, right? The governor, lieutenant governor, our U.S. senators, I interacted with congressmen, I interacted with state reps, state senators, interacted with local politicians of both parties. A couple things I took away. The world of politics moves insanely slowly. It's incredibly hard to get things done because competing agendas are so rampant that they sort of define the landscape. In other words, if you go in and say, man, I want to get this thing done because I believe it will serve the population this way. Even if somebody else may say, yeah, that's a great thing to get done, but I don't want you to get the credit for that because that means if I have to run against you in the future, then you could be like, there's just, you wouldn't believe the bizarre integration of these competing agendas. So compared to a founder, for example, an entrepreneur, where you, and if you build a team around you, can set a clear objective, man, it can be very frustrating. And so you learn a lot of patience and understanding and how to approach these things, knowing that sometimes the best you can do is advocate. In other words, you can't actually make something happen. Whereas in your business, you can. But as an elected official, the best you can do is advocate. You can speak publicly about something that would be a good idea and why it would matter to the general population. But that takes empathy, right? You have to learn to understand people that you will never see and meet through what's happening in their landscape. And so I learned a lot about not just people skills, but how to think about the greater good in a way that I was never challenged to think before. And I think that certainly has affected our business for sure.
And in this case, I mean, putting the company or your experience at the company in pause, because now you go and explore politics for 6 years, how were you able to set people up and the company up for success, you know, for you to be okay with, you know, not being there day to day for 6 years?
You know, I'll say what I did, and I'll pass on the most profound lesson I learned from that. Because there's an important question that I think most founders probably don't ever have an instance like this to learn from. So what happened? There was, you know, I ran the company for, you know, like I said, 10 years. Prior to this, I said eight, nine years. And during that time, a lot of guys who had like come in fairly early were with me. So there was a group of 20 or so people who had been at the company with me for years. And when I went, and it's not like I was going to disappear completely. I would still be there to coach. I just couldn't be in the day-to-day operations. And so they were stepping in. We even went outside and found two external CEOs during that. Actually, three external CEOs. But really, it was this core team that ran the business. And you know what's interesting, Alejandro? After I left the company, from the time I left in 2014, January 2014, to 2020 when I came back, the company grew in size by 50%. So you might say, well, clearly Ryan wasn't all that good at this because they grew without him, for sure. But then I say that, but then in 2019, we hit our top year. I came back in 2020, and it was already on a downhill swing. And then from COVID hurt us pretty hard. 2020, 2021, and 2022 were each of those years, it kind of went down like this and leveled out. 2023 and then 2024, we're back to growing again. And what I want to pass on, I think was an important lesson is, as a founder and as a leader of an organization of 500 people at that size, the things that we do almost never impact today, but they can impact 5 years down the road. So not that I was solely responsible for the company's growth over those 5 years, I wasn't here, but I can look at, if you ask the people that were here before I served in public office, while I was gone in public office, and since I would come back, they'll look back and say what happened in the 2014, 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19, during that 6 year period. The things that we created in the first 8 years carried us through for those 6 years. So even though we had changes, we had three different CEOs during that time. But the way we did business, our core principles, that the mechanics of running the company were in place. Now, what's interesting is during that 6 year period, though, some of those things started to wane. So as I was coming back, and even upon reflection now, if you look at from 2019 to 2020, 2021, 2022, we paid the price in those years for things that were not solidified in the years of growth. So during those years of growth, people got complacent. They stopped caring intimately about customers because, man, we were growing in leaps and bounds. We weren't out serving the sites as well as we should have been. And so, man, what I'm saying through all this is sometimes the actions we take and the impacts of those actions, sometimes that gap is 5 years. And often founders aren't patient enough to understand that. But a lot of times, if really good business leaders, really good leaders in general, especially large organizations, have to be thinking with that long-term vision. Because I can tell you from our data, from our experience, that's the impacts that we make, are the long-term ones, rarely short-term.
So let's talk about vision then. Let's double click on that. Imagine you were to go to sleep tonight, Ryan, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Pinnacle is fully realized. What does that world look like?
Oh, man. Yeah. You know, you think about what I'll call large industrial facilities. Chemical plants, lumber mills, mining facilities, wastewater treatment plants, refineries. If you think about everything we use every day, Alejandro, from glasses to computers, they're all produced in large industrial complexes. And reliability is the single biggest lever that most of those facilities can pull to both compete and to succeed. Why is that? Because in the end, let's use refineries, for example, there are 600 refineries in the world. They all buy crude oil and they all sell gasoline, kerosene, diesel, whatever. So they're all doing kind of the same thing, but in slightly different ways. Yes, they can invest in making the refinery bigger. They can invest in more advanced chemical processes. But the biggest one, the refineries that are the best in the world, they're the most reliable. The reliability is the biggest needle. Power generation facilities, right? They all have this. And I'll add into that reliability, when we don't have reliability in society today, our world freaks out. And I have to use no example any further back than COVID. Do you remember when we started hearing rumors that, man, paper products out of China might be constrained as a result of supply chains? And you saw pictures of people wheeling carts out of Costco with a 2-year supply of toilet paper. Think about that. That somebody going, oh my God, there might be a shortage. I need 2 years of toilet paper. Like people's minds just go berserk when the reliability of our basic needs is at risk. So you asked about our vision. I envision a world in which people, everybody around the world and all these facilities know, if you want to make your plant more reliable, Pinnacle is the game. Pinnacle they are the clear leaders in this space. They have the subject matter expertise. They've got the technology. They've got the personnel. They've got the training systems. They are an easy button for reliability. So if you ran a chemical plant and you say, dude, I'm tired of trying to figure this out. My guys are good at running the plant. We're not good at reliability strategies. I just go partner with Pinnacle. And yes, I spend a dollar on Pinnacle, but I get $3 back in cost savings and profitability. And if you look down the road, say 10 years from now, our company's probably doing something like $2 to $3 billion a year in revenue because we are delivering $10 to $15 billion a year in value to our customers. You know, we've got, at this point, back to this vision, that we're revolutionizing the way each one of them use their data to make better real-time decisions about what maintenance to do and what assets to upgrade. Our people are excited to go into plants every day because they know, man, when I go into this plant, I'm going to make a difference there. I'm going to make that plant run better. And it's going to be a fun interaction to go figure out how to do better things with their data and with our systems. You know, you're probably talking about us having 2,000 or 3,000 employees, and they're spread out all around the world in every country that we have a good relationship with.
That will be a beautiful day to wake up to, huh? Now I guess for the people that are listening to get it too, in terms of scope and size for Pinnacle, how many people do you have now, and what other numbers do you feel comfortable sharing?
Sure. So we got about 500 people today. We'll do this year probably do $75 million in revenue. That's down from our peak, as I said, quite a bit actually. But we're growing again. So last year, this year, and next year, we already have a good sense of that. So we're back in this track. And I'll even say this: during the last 3 years, we invested very heavily in a new software application. So one that the world has never seen before. It's an incredibly advanced reliability modeling system that called Newton. That the world has never seen anything like before. And that's just beginning to go to market right now. So we're a combination of services and technology and true engineering expertise all rolled into this package. But anyway, that's kind of our size today. And we have a pretty good sense over the next couple of years. If you ask me, what do I think is going to happen over the next 2025, 26, I'm expecting us to grow by probably on the low side 20, I'd say between 20 and 40% over that period of time. And mostly in just total revenue, but it'll be a combination of technology and sort of total services and solutions all rolled into one thing.
So one thing that is incredible here is also the way that you've thought about giving that sense of ownership to employees. In this case, you own 75, or so of the company in terms of percentage, but the rest is owned by employees, and you do plan on not leaving anything, to anyone, unless, for example, your kids, decide to work at the company. So walk us through that plan and that structure that you put together there, because it's quite unique.
Well, thank you. And I'll say why I landed at that. It's not like my kids are, not going to get anything from us. They just, the Pinnacle probably represents, 80 to 90% of my and my family's net worth. And what I realized over time is why would I just leave this to our kids unless they really want to be here and be a part of this and lead this? Because there's an amazing team here. And people that are incredibly devoted to each other, to serving our customers, to doing things that have an impact on the world. And so, the plan is, hey, we're going to leave this company to them. And I'll even get into a little bit of the mechanics. How I think this is going to play out is we will end up selling the stock to employees, but we'll sell it at whatever they can afford to pay for it. So my goal is not to maximize. Let's say I could go out in the open market and buy a share of Pinnacle or sell a share for $20 for some reason. I may sell it to an employee for $2. I don't say I don't care, but I don't. What's most important is that the person who's getting that share, that their mindset is, yes, I own this today, but I'm really just stewarding it. I'm going to take my role as an owner and shepherd this company for the next, whatever it's going to be, 20 years. And then I'm going to turn around and I'm going to sell it to somebody else. And they're going to do this too. My hope is that we build this legacy, that this culture around, really, this is about people who love working together, love going out and doing things out in the world. Yes, while I'm a shareholder, make really good money. The dividends are great. We make good money. We get to take the vacations and do all the nice things we want to do. But our value here is not selling the company. Our value here is running the company well and doing great things out in the world and then passing this ownership on to the next generation. I know that I've never heard anybody else talk about doing that with their company. I just think that that's the way that a company, that a group of people have the biggest impact on society. So that's why we want to do it that
way. So, by the way, that's incredible and super profound and very unique. Now, I want to put you into a time machine. And I want to bring you back in time. I want to bring you back to around 2016 or perhaps, around that time where you were now on the couch, you were, lying down, watching TV, maybe eating ice cream because you were like super disappointed with what had happened, with the previous job. And let's say you're able to show up right there in front of that younger self, lying down on the couch, and you're able to capture the attention of that younger Ryan. And you give that younger Ryan one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Okay, so this is the 2006. This is the Ryan that just got fired from the job.
So 2024 Ryan is right sitting in front of 2006 Ryan.
Okay. So at that point, I wasn't thinking. I was thinking about starting my own company, but didn't have the stones yet. So I'm sitting there, sitting in front of Ryan. I said, "Hey, Ryan, here's the one piece of advice I would give you." Man, it's a good question, Alejandro. I think I would try to, it would be something like this. Ryan, you will be surprised how few companies are really built around a value set in which they're going to say, we will make a dollar by making our customers $2. There's lots of ways to do that, right? Investors can do that. But if you're going to do that with reliability, build your company around that, which is what we did anyway. It just took me a long time to realize that that was really what it was about. So I would give that Ryan that advice and I would add into it. And Ryan, anybody you hire that doesn't align with that, you have to fire fast. I wouldn't experience this pain for a while, but if we talked about this in the opening, there's a little bit, but if you look over that 18-year period, my biggest mistake consistently has been allowing people to stick around too long who were smart, maybe were hard workers, whatever, but they really didn't buy into what we're doing and they were a cultural drag. And I would go back and tell that guy, Ryan, be uncompromising. Don't ask yourself, am I sure that they don't align? And because if you're not certain they don't align, then you won't fire them. Ask if you're not sure that they do align, then you have to move them out. There's lots of jobs out there, lots of good people that can get jobs lots of places. There's a lot of good people that do not belong in your company. You say our job is to go out and do really cool reliability stuff, creative things to make a difference for that customer in ways that they don't even understand today. And if you hire somebody that's not aligned with that, get rid of them now. That'd be the advice I'd give them.
Amazing. I love it. So Ryan, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
So a couple of ways. Obviously, I'm on social media, but I'll admit I don't use it very well. So LinkedIn, you know, I'm on there. If someone really want to reach out, just drop me an email, ryan@ryansitton.com. And, you know, I don't always respond quickly, but I will eventually. And so, yeah, if someone wanted to reach out and connect, like I said, through social media or that email would be great.
Amazing. Well, easy enough. Well, hey, Ryan, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
It's been an honor to be here.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.